him total control of the company. Chris, as a Twitter user, what are your thoughts about this?
I think it's going to definitely change the platform pretty drastically. I think Elon is definitely going to adopt a more libertarian stance in regards to kind of content moderation, what accounts are going to be able to kind of stay online, what accounts might be coming back. I think the question on everyone's mind is whether or not Donald Trump will be back on the platform.
Yeah, I've always been like, you know, a bit critical of Elon Musk. You know, anyone who kind of has heard me talk about him before will know that. But I would say, like, personally, I think that, you know, Twitter is always going to, like, kind of, to a certain extent, continue to be Twitter, because I think one of the biggest appeals of it is people just pissing each other off on there and going back and forth. So some of left people, some of right people, I feel like, are going to have to stay on for it to be kind of like a, you know, a sensible company. But I do think, you know, most likely the censorship, if there's going to be any, it's just going to be people who Elon Musk, you know, who Elon Musk doesn't like.
Yeah, I think I saw a recent tweet of his saying that, like, content moderation on a social media platform is done best if the, like, most extreme 10% of both right and left are equally pissed off. So
yeah,
I don't. It's hard to see how kind of that, like, censorship will apply to kind of both sides of the coin. But yeah, it'll be very interesting to see who he kind of appoints as CEO. I know I've seen a couple of mentions earlier today of potentially Jack Dorsey coming back as CEO. Though he is doing a lot with Square, so maybe not.
But. Yeah, I've heard a lot of interesting, because obviously the guy who they have in there now is probably not long for the world.
Certainly not. No.
Yeah, he's very much known for the kind of more aggressive kind of content moderation type of situation. Musk actually ended up purchasing the company at $54.20 a share, the same price that he actually named in the offer earlier. I think it's going to be very interesting, because, you know, most likely, I think it'll probably, you know, continue on uninterrupted, or at least to a certain extent. But
absolutely. I mean, I think no one's going to be really leaving the platform. I think that's kind of a bunch of unfounded threats, kind of like, oh, if Trump wins, I'm going to move to Canada.
Exactly. Yeah, I just saw that.
Like,
yeah.
That's a pretty baseless threat. And it's such, Twitter's like the lifeblood of so many politicians and so many prominent public figures. It will continue. And in many ways, this could be interesting for Twitter, as, you know, a potentially younger generation or a lot of people who are maybe more attracted to Musk kind of move to the platform to see what it's about.
Yeah, I think that's going to be, because, yeah, there's just so many different, like, types of Twitter, and, like, big part of it, though, is, like, so many politicians are on Twitter, like, making news, and just, like, it is such a major forum for world announcements, so that's why I think, you know, to a certain extent, they're probably going to have to keep it, you know, relatively, like, free-flowing, at least, at least similar to the way it is now. Some people may not think that is free-flowing, but... the biggest question is, will Trump get back? Because that could have a lot of... Because I feel like, you know... I've heard different arguments. Do you think being off Twitter has helped or hurt Trump over these last few... or last year or so?
I think it's certainly... I think overall it's hurt him. I think it's coalesced a certain more extreme part of his sort of support, where the more devoted Trump voters are going to kind of continue seeking his message and using platforms like Telegram and others, which are, like, encrypted, uncensored, in order to kind of still keep up to date with Trump. But I don't think he's not having those same viral moments that we saw in 2016 and certainly in 2020, where he's kind of, like, denouncing the election or, like, spreading these wild claims that then are, like, totally broadcast on every single major cable news platform. Like, for example, I remember back in the 2016 election, any kind of Trump tweet that would incite a reaction or news companies would think would get clicks was certainly
instantly
on the front page. And from that, I think he gained a lot of traction and popularity.
Yeah, I think that's two very good points, because, like, if you are, you know, the certain kind of people who would be kind of hold your nose and vote for Trump people, which were, you know, a big part of his base, you know, that probably really does help him, you know, to have him off Twitter and not, like, saying all this stuff. And so people start to remember, you know, gas prices were high, you know, the libs were mad, maybe it wasn't that bad, you know, like, and then that starts to get, you know, things a little bit better. But then, you know, that huge pull that Trump had over the media, it'll be tough to see, you know, it'll probably get it if he does run again, but it'll be tough to see anything as strong as it was in 2016, where even like CNN, you know, MSNBC, all these places that, you know, still hated him could not help but cover every word that he said.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that is all some very interesting stuff with Twitter getting sold here. But let's go on to our, you know, world field trip here. As our first stop will be in Beijing. A very interesting situation going on right now. As, you know, most of the world, I think, smartly has decided to, you know, kind of live with COVID. You know, kind of at, you know, at great cost to them, you know, but up to getting this point. But there obviously is one exception now that is, you know, feeling cost in a different way, and that is China. The Chinese capital of Beijing kicked off mass testing for millions here, according to the BBC. 26 cases just in one district over the weekend, the highest number so far in Beijing's latest surge. So, yeah, Chris, you've been following this, I know. What do you think is going on here?
I mean, I think this is going to be, in about 2 weeks, we're going to see, over the coming 2 weeks, we're going to see kind of Shanghai-esque lockdowns. Mm. And for those who aren't really familiar, Shanghai's been totally locked down since about cases were started reporting kind of end of March. And since then, increasing lockdowns of increasing strictness have been imposed on the city. There have been a lot of really heartbreaking moments. They're kind of symptoms of an authoritarian government. You know, positive infants being separated from their children, pets of positive cases. People are kind of taken away in bags and slaughtered, and a lot of really lack of access to like clean food, water. Fences are actually now being put up around apartment buildings where there are high numbers of COVID cases. And I really think that this is going to kind of be the lockdown situation we're going to start to see in Beijing. I think China and the CCP have really kind of miscalculated on this zero COVID policy because it's just not sustainable. I mean, you look at kind of the systems they're being put in place to contain this virus, their strong denouncement of anti-Western vaccines, which are of Western vaccines, which are far more efficient, effective than anything China has managed to produce with the new mRNA technology. There's really no stopping kind of the ability of Omicron to spread. And that's kind of being seen. I think Shanghai reported on Saturday, I think 20,000 new cases. So that city will probably remain locked down in the foreseeable future. I think one by one, Chinese cities will kind of fall into lockdown. Yeah,
we're seeing a very much kind of a similar pattern here. You know, these long queues outside the supermarkets and shops. We're seeing, and you know, it does seem like, you know, we saw very similar scenes in America, but the theme there is more chaos. Here we have, you know, drones kind of circling above being like, you know, control your urge to go outside and seek freedom in your heart or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, that is literally what, like, there's videos of that happening, which just seems so, so crazy.
I mean, I think in the United States, when COVID started happening, you saw those crazy lines. I think word used there was very accurate, but it was very much more in an individualistic sense. In China, I think the word I would use is desperation. Mm-hmm. That these people are seeing, you know, posts before they're taken down by censors on Weibo that there's no food in Shanghai, there's no water, all of this stuff. So they're desperate before, like, such a stringent lockdown comes to Beijing to kind of avoid those consequences. And, I mean, people are starting to get angry. I mean, there's one video that went kind of semi-viral on Saturday called Voices of April. It was about a six-minute video kind of comprised of all of these, like, audio clips of people in lockdown in Shanghai, of like people who aren't able to get groceries, infants separated from their parents, people being rejected from hospitals, all things like that. And that's been kind of taken down, was brought down pretty quickly by censors, but it's now been kind of transformed into this game of cat and mouse where people are embedding it in QR codes, putting it in, like, burying it in, like, cartoon clips, like all this thing to try and, like, keep spreading it.
Yeah, that definitely seems like it's going to not really go away for sure anytime soon. But what with these vaccines, I was like looking at percentages, and it seems like there is pretty high vaccine, especially on Hong Kong, but also on the mainland, of just people taking these vaccines. What have they been using, like their own or like the Cuban vaccine or something that's just not been working?
Yeah,
or
I mean,
they're getting it like here, and it's just not a severe case, or like what is like the, how bad is it hitting people? Are the deaths piling up, like hospitalizations?
So, I mean, obviously, the numbers are pretty small compared to kind of like what we're desensitized to in the United yeah. States. But obviously, when you're pursuing a strict zero COVID policy, 20,000 cases in a day is pretty extreme. The main kind of the two things on that, I would say, is one, given Xi Jinping and the Communist Party's very like anti-Western stance and its kind of determination to prove that China is a world power, they have really like isolated themselves in using only Chinese-made products. So the, I believe the biggest one's called Sinovac. There's another one called CoronaVac. And they really, they use outdated vaccine technology that's just not nearly as effective as the mRNA of Pfizer and Moderna. Secondly, vaccine hesitancy is actually a really large issue in China, especially in the population, most vulnerable population of 60 and up.
Oh, really?
There's really, especially in Hong Kong was pretty bad, and the mainland, a lot of people, elderly people aren't taking the vaccine, which is leading to increased hospitalizations and deaths.
So it's more kind of the reverse situation that we had here, which is higher uptake with the older population. And so that's causing mostly, because I think a big, if they really for some reason decide to go zero COVID, the way that I think would probably be best is if a bunch of them are either immunized through getting it or being vaccinated, and that would obviously let it be able to go through with a lot less severe illnesses.
Yeah, and another thing to consider is we see in the United States how easily Omicron is ripping through vaccinated populations. I know I've gotten a fully vaccinated, boosted with Pfizer, which is probably the most effective one on the market. It's really like these weaker Chinese vaccines that don't use mRNA techniques were fine against original Alpha strain, competent against Delta, but really stand no chance against Omicron. They really have no chance of preventing infection.
Yeah. So, and of course, if you're infected with kind of a vaccine that's not going to be, as protective, it could be a very, very serious situation there. I think if they really have to go zero COVID and, it's people are highly vaccinated with an effective vaccine, I think that's doable. But then it really gets crazy if, that's going to lead to mass amounts of hospitalizations and deaths.
Absolutely. And I think another point to bring up is how much stake Xi and the CCP have put into zero COVID. They've really outlined for the past 2 years, their propaganda machine has kind of been working at full force, making zero COVID kind of a proof of their system of governance being really effective. Like, there's been a lot of propaganda about how in the West, it's okay for everyone to catch COVID and die, but in China, the government is working to prevent that, and you don't have to worry about it. And when COVID is ripping through society like this, and they're seeing such stringent lockdowns, it's kind of it pulls all of that into question, which is something that the government can't really stand.
Yeah, that is a very intriguing. So it's about the kind of self-identity of running this smoother, and now, it is not being run so smooth. All right, we're going to take a quick PSA break, and then we will start with our music. But first, we have this message about texting.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Well, as you may have heard, there was a very interesting election in a Western European country, and we will be discussing that in just a few minutes. But first, get ready for the spring fling, because we got a little bit of Amine coming for you on WMFO.
Boy, I got it.
This is Britney Spears when she was bald. Punk it way before there was punk. Smoking Ashton Kutch, so I calmed down. We don't wanna hear your mixtape, my. I fade like barbers. I got more pressure in my palms than Arthur. Man, it's like when Fergie peed her pants. That's when Honey used to dance. Matt Barnes versus Derek Fisher caught you in the. I hate when don't finish they sentences. If Steve Harvey said my name wrong, I'll catch a sentence. Malice at the palace, or Winona up in Saks Fifth. This is metal world peace before the peace came. Bitch.
Precious my arms.
Yeah, I got that.
Precious my arms.
Boy, I got that.
Precious my arms.
Why they keep eyeing me? Plank is mahogany, your head leaking burgundy. Minister society, you're more of Ron Weasley. Into gynecology, you're
CNS.
I hate the b- you think a baby finna keep it. Where every time he see his kids, we gotta see the picture. I do it big and no one ballin', don't just see the ticker. Feel like I'm hard and I was shootin' on her teaser with him. Baby says she need commitment, I guess I think about it. I never leave without it, he down to squeeze without it. I keep a bad and bougie booty on 100,000. Big headed, barely fit her weave around it. North.
Precious in my arms.
Boy, I got that.
Precious in my arms.
In your face, you think you running sh- but running in place. I'm taking the base, yeah, I'm taking it home. I'm a young jacket, if I hit it, it's gone. You bitch, quick scallywag, silly motherfucker. I threw your ass the same way that Ye did Taylor, or how they did Janet. You wouldn't understand it. Hola, 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 yeah, fell Spanish. Passive aggressive, too passive, I can't save you. Anticipating patience is something I cannot favor. Goodbye to you. I'll probably see you never. How could you hate on us? Come on, homie, we major. We major. Come on, homie, we major. The ice so cold and I don't do favors. I did it on my own and I do it again. I guess my cut co-sign singing.
Pressure in my palms.
There ain't no money in having hate in your heart. There ain't no money in that.
So that's we
rewind. Yeah. Way, way, way up. Turn it all up. Yeah. Look, I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of my energy. They trying to take away from a with the kid and pray for you. I got girls in real life tryna f*** up my day. Going online, that ain't part of my day. I got real popping with my family too. I got that can never leave Canada too. I got 2 mortgages, 30 million in total. I got that'll still try f*** me over. I got rap that I gotta act like I like, but my acting days are over for life. Yeah, I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of this energy. Trying to take away from it. With the kid and pray for you. I got people talking down, man, like I give a f-. I bought this one a purse, I bought this one a truck. I bought this one a house, I bought this one a mall. I keep buying, just make sure you keep track of it all. I got asking me about the code for the Wi-Fi, so they can talk about the timeline and show me pictures of their friends.
just to tell me they ain't really friends. Ex-girl, she the female version of me. I got strippers in my life, but they virgins to me. I hear everybody talking about what they gon' be. I got high hopes for you, we gon' see. I got money in the courts, so all my are free. About to call your ass a Uber, I got somewhere to be. I hear fairy tales about how they gon' run up on me. Well, run up when you see me, then we gon' see. I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of this energy. Trying to take away from it. With the kid and pray for you. Yeah. Yeah. Nah, fuck all of you. I ain't finished. Y'all don't wanna hear me say it's a go. Y'all don't wanna see win-win 50 or woe. I got real ones living past Kennedy Row. I got real ones with me everywhere that I go. I'm trying to tell you, I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Every time I see them, something wrong with their memory. Trying to take away from it. So tired of saving all these. Mike. I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of this energy. Trying to take away from it. With the kid and pray for you.
Got a little bit of Vince Staples there, Love Can Be, preceded by some Drake here for you on WMFO. We're back here with Chris. Chris, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, been fun so far. We got some interesting news coming out of France. A remarkable result that defied modern precedent. Emmanuel Macron was re-elected president of France yesterday night. In the second and final round of voting, the centrist incumbent got an impressive 58.5%. This is down from his 66% last time, but this is, again, somebody who has an only 36% approval rating with the national public, so our French public. What do you think of that win?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very glad that he won over Le Pen. I think that would have been an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
But it is concerning to see how quickly the margin has shrunk between the two, especially given kind of how unimpressive Le Pen was in their one debate and the way she's been running her campaign and her pro-Russia stance. I mean,
Especially in a time like this,
I would have thought anyone with such kind of strong ties and such an anti-NATO stance would have been totally crushed in the polls. But it kind of goes to show how kind of dissatisfied some of the French are with Macron's performance.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I did love Ron Klain, the Joe Biden chief of staff, tweeting, you know, just a little note for people, you know, you can do really well with a 36% approval rating. Like, all right, buddy,
yeah,
we'll see
okay.
about that.
I don't know about that one.
But that is definitely something, because it very much shows that, you know, I think it's fair, even though she definitely is by no means, you know, centrist or anything like that, she definitely, Le Pen, has tried to come a little bit off of her, I've heard, far-right position. Would you say that's fair, since the last election?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's not running as kind of a Donald Trump, per se. I think she definitely learned from some of her mistakes, and margins certainly reflect that a little bit. But, you know, there's still obviously extremist parts of her candidacy. I mean, the anti-hijab legislation was kind of a premier part of her package, and I think there's definitely a lot of aspects where she was kind of trying to motivate more rural parts of France that have been kind of left behind to go to the polls.
Yeah, I think that was very interesting, because if you look at, like, a big concern was they had a kind of Bernie Sanders style candidate who came a very close third in the general round, the first round. And there was a lot of pressure on him, because last time I think he refused to endorse actually Macron, because he is obviously, you know, very much, he's a very far left guy,
right.
Disagrees with Macron on a lot of economic and policy, and, you know, especially since Macron has in his term gone much more aggressive on Islamic immigration and religion. In his time, he's faced a lot of criticism for that, and I think it shows that there is kind of like a almost three-way divide in French politics.
And I mean, I think coming from the United States, it's definitely a little difficult. Like, I think the overall European sentiment, the whole immigration question is so loaded and so intense that it's really kind of a defining part of any politician's kind of path. So, I don't know. I feel like that's a little difficult for us to see as Americans.
Yeah, and we definitely have our kind of own immigration dynamic with the southern border here, but, coming over, you know, they're obviously coming from a different place, you know, for kind of different reasons indirect reasons.
There's a lot more of them. The Syrian refugee crisis is an absolute tragedy.
Yeah.
And kind of the overall load on the EU can't really be understated, and especially there's a lot of pressure on these politicians, what policy they're going to adopt with Ukraine now, given kind of, it's obviously, you know, a similar wartime, a lot of refugees, but like, how are they going to react compared to those Middle Eastern countries?
Yeah, I think like the interesting thing you said, the kind of the anti-NATO kind of like skepticism stance, because I personally, as somebody who has been, you know, a bit skeptical of the way things have turned out, with the United States on top of the world from, you know, post-World War II period on, and wanting to kind of, you know, change that, I feel like that, you know, skepticism has grown a lot more political purchase in the last, you know, 5-6 years. And I think that really shows when you have, you know, the popularity of Mélenchon, the left-wing candidate, and then you have Le Pen, someone who is really, you know, wrong in so many ways, but has that very, and still going to come out and say that, you know, NATO should be disbanded, and, you know, trying to, you know, cozy up to Putin, and then still getting all of this purchase. You know, it's like, it's what I wonder is that skepticism more of like a, you know, right wing kind of thing, or more of a I don't like the current, you know, foreign policy establishment kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can come at it from two different angles. I mean, I think both sides of the extreme will find ways not to like NATO. I mean, I think, you know, a more far left, maybe your perspective more will be like, I don't want the American hegemon to kind of dominate world politics, and think it's not totally fair that we have such control. And, you know, far right might be like, look at how this is kind of like I don't want to say maybe they don't. It's hard to say, like, oh, it's like a weapon for democracy or something, but it certainly does chip away at authoritarian prowess and is probably one of our greatest checks against authoritarian power. And those who are more sympathetic to, say, China or Russia would also probably like to see NATO gone.
And also this kind of, like, you know, globalist, you know, kind of terminology. You know, Le Pen used that. She's calling it a choice between the people and the cozy globalist elite of Paris. In the end, enough voters, especially those on the left who dislike Macron, and actually, you know, by the way, it did turn out to be a very strong, you know, because this time around, the left-wing candidate said no vote should ever go to, you know, the racist Marine Le Pen, and, you know, only, I think it was, 15% versus, like, 42% of his supporters voted for Le Pen versus Macron. A bunch, you know, stayed home, which I think is going to be is it going to be a commonality across the world? A swing towards to keep Le Pen out. Do you think that kind of strategy of kind of uniting against the right wing candidate in this kind of broad coalition, it kind of worked for Biden and it's kind of worked for Le Pen here. Do you think that's going to be a successful kind of long term strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's. Long term, it's hard to say because when you have a candidate like Biden in office, I mean, I think we've seen he's not really been able to get much done. You know, his greatest kind of moments like this, I would say he's doing a fairly good job on the Ukraine front and kind of doing a pretty good job on the China front. I think those have come at the expense of really challenging authoritarian powers. And on the home front, he's really struggled kind of uniting that same coalition. I think it works to get those figures into office when you can kind of stoke up fears of the other side. But in the long term, actually getting policy done, it's kind of falls short.
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to be a big problem. He was called the McKinsey candidate, I believe. That is definitely, a branding that, especially in a country that's very quick to protest, you know, like France, mm-hmm. when he tried to, like, lower that retirement age several times, reform the pensions, like, that has been, a historic...
Yellow jacket protests.
Has been a very common historic problem for them. The final result matched the polling trends in the two-week runoff. But before the first round of voting on April 10th, things were looking good for Le Pen. She had a shrewd campaign focused on rural and those rural and semi-rural areas. You talked about that got left behind. She dwelt on cost of living, which is the voters' top concern, and Macron left it woefully late to start campaigning in earnest. But in the run-up to the second round, the polls shifted Macron's way. Mm-hmm. This is the debate that you talked about with Le Pen's links to Vladimir Putin really kind of getting laid out, calling him her banker due to a still outstanding loan her party took out with a Russian bank in 2014. So yeah, I think that kind of shows you maybe that there is some sort of, you know, that feeling there in France kind of strong and, you know, causing her to tank in the polls like that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's also from a European perspective, seeing an aggressor invade a country so close to home, there's no way you can't be sympathetic with the Ukrainian people, especially seeing kind of those refugees pour in, seeing footage all day, because it really is a close to home issue and kind of the first real major European aggression since World War II. So that would obviously kind of tank any candidate that has those ties to Putin and Russia.
Yeah, I think, that is something that even with the, surprisingly strong result, with all the skepticism for NATO and close ties to Putin, that is something that you really just cannot ignore at the end of the day. But the challenge now for Macron is going to be forming this government, because he does have, it seems, a pretty fractured coalition, especially with they got the legislative elections coming up, I believe, in short order. Mm-hmm. And they got, split up between Greens, Socialists, centrist, center-right, Republicans, and all this kind of situation. So it looks like, at the end of the day, we could be back in focusing on France very, very soon, because it doesn't seem like anything's settled.
Yeah, certainly not. I mean, having Macron back in power is definitely a relief, but it'll be kind of more of a deep dive into the French kind of psyche, seeing how these like more district elections play out, for sure.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing will obviously be because like the French left, especially with I forget who it was, but the president they had, I think, concurrent to like Obama was alongside Obama during the Obama era, was very detrimental to the left, and they're just now kind of
he had some scandal. I don't recall. Yeah, I don't exactly remember what it was.
He had
some
like three different affairs.
It was ridiculous. That was it.
You know, yeah, he was a mess. And so they just have this guy now, Mélenchon, trying to lead, you know, a very fractured, you know, we got like the communists, the greens, you know, all these different types of people, you know, into a next election, and hopefully try and take some of that, you know, populist anger and lead it to a better, more kind of productive place. At least that's what I'm hoping. Yeah, so that is definitely going to be something very, very interesting to watch. But any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really followed the France situation closely, but I think it is kind of a good indicator. I mean, it definitely speaks something to the French people to re-elect Macron. I mean, as you touched on earlier, it's the first time in 20 years that an incumbent has regained office. So he's a good, solid figure. I mean, I wouldn't expect any radical policies or great shifts coming out of him, but that's kind of, I think, what Europe might need in the next 5 years.
Yeah. That will be definitely something we want to keep an eye on there. And with that, we'll get right back into the music with a little bit of YG. How about that?
To the door.
When my dogs at? We right here, dog. Where my dogs at?
right here, dog. Where my dogs at? We right here, dog. Now where my dogs at? I said, get at me. Ain't talking to you, but that rap beat. Get at me. Ostrich skin seats like it's acne. Get at me. Never tacky jeans made by acne. Governor Pataki's in Patakis. It's about to get uglier than Balenciagas. Felt bad, I never finished college. Now we f- cuties with booties and dapper dance silk pajamas. Living a dream, open up your eyelids. Me and Flacco on the island with a few bad bitches. How my cousin make a meal off a do-rag business. All my dogs with the sh** with a few cat litters. All the yellow with the black, like the woo back. Back when I was wetting beds, I was still catching head. If I was busting dishes, I'd be still f***. Booth pack, get wrapped just like Christmas. Gone for a minute, now I'm back, did you miss me? Had the whole Harlem world wearing Under Armours, under the armors. I'm a pretty mother, comma, gorgeous, comma. Pretty much about to f*** your mama, kinda. Running late for this meeting with Obama. I ain't mean it to rhyme, but call me when your mind right. Meet me with your romper, see me when the vibe right. More money, more problem, more chopper, more drama. And I got these hoes, feeling like my bomber. My dog's at, right here, dog. Where my dog's at? Right here, dog. Where my dog's at? Right here, dog. Now where my dog's at? Right here, dog. Who gon' do what? My dog's gon' do what? Nigga, look out, cause look down like once you. And we don't give to. Where I'm from, you lunch, you food. Caught your bluff. Pockets worn, brother. Security guard too buff. I like my song screwed up. I own a go-to brush. I get my go-to buck. I'ma stomp a n- out into Milan, new buck. Young buck, two buck. Benz truck, new truck. Big horns, two buck. More good than Cuba. They try to hit us like Huey with the armpits up. But we swerve through the bullets, get your targets up. Hood pump up in this gin trap, Lord, we try. Now where my dogs at? Right here, dog. Where my dogs at? Right here, dog. Where my dogs at? Right here, dog. Now where my dogs at? I said, get at me. Ain't talking to you, no, with that rap beat. Get at me. Ostrich skin seats like it's acne. Get at me. Never tacky jeans made by acne. Governor Pataki's in Pataki.
Yeah, you don't want no one. No, I can't lie. You don't want no one. Stay with it, knees. Keep it blunt. New girl for the month. Big ride out the bunch. And I know that it gets old and it gets cold. Just pull up, but when you're outside before the gate cold. Need a lot to keep you gay. Finally realized that it put you safe. As you all grow, but you learned your lesson. It's been a long time, but you still get sexy. Oh, you still got it. Always asking what you doing. Tell him take you shopping. He don't do it for you. Baby, get a different option. Got you coming out the crib and he ain't coming out of pocket. How long that's gonna take? No, you just wanna escape. No, you just wanna break. But girl, you gotta embrace. Yeah. And I know that it gets old and it gets cold. Just pull up, but when you're outside, before the gate cold. Need a lot to keep you gay. Finally realized that it put you safe. As you all grow, but you learned your lesson. It's a long time, but you still get sexy. Still get sexy. Call my phone or text me. Yeah. It's about that time to come roll out. But it's so long, bound for a blowout. Do your dance, you love to show up. Going crazy, I ain't know, but I know now. Let me pull up later, show you how I'm rocking. Do you all a favor? And I know that it gets old and it gets cold. Just pull up, but when you're outside, before the gate cold. Need a lot to keep you gay. Only realize that it put you safe. It's all broke, but you learned your lesson. It's a long time, but you still get sexy.
Don Toliver, Escape is name of that one there. So welcome you back into the studio here today. We got about, you know, 16 minutes left on the show today. We got Chris back with us. Chris, thank you once again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
All right. We're talking about, you know, we're doing our world field trip here. And we are, you know, heading right back over to Russia and Ukraine. But specifically through the context of Taiwan, because you can kind of like look at, you know, Russia as Russia is to Ukraine as Ukraine is to Russia as Taiwan is to China. I guess you could, is that a fair?
Absolutely, that's a fair comparison.
Fair comparison, I mean, there.
China has never really accepted any claims of Taiwanese independence, and it's really insisted that it's a part of China that's kind of independently government, kind of falls under the old Hong Kong of one country, two systems. And that is totally reflected in Russia's stance on Ukraine, that Ukraine is kind of, or at least the Vladimir Putin stance, I don't know if it's coalesced as like a whole Russia, but Vladimir Putin's stance at least is that Ukraine is a part of Russia that is simply kind of like not within its borders at the moment. Like the people there are Russian, their traditions are Russian, and but de facto they're like part of Russia.
Like long lost brother type of situation. You're just like waiting to come home.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it does seem that unsurprisingly here, that people in Taiwan have very much rallied around the Ukrainian cause. As here, this is in The Economist. It's in Taipei, talking about this sign that says China and Russia. You know, Long Bai Wei Zhan, which is a wolf and a bai, which is a mythical beast that they're supposed to be colluding to do evil. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see how it goes there. With China and Russia declaring their friendship has no limits, Taiwanese fear they will be the next prey. How to Survive in the Bookshop, we're talking about Krav Maga, but, you know, how real do you think, you know, because of course, you know, Russia, Ukraine, like, who ever thought that was going to come? You know, we've been hearing about Taiwan and China for so long. You know, how real is this threat, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is certainly a real threat. But I think it is, as you said, it's kind of impossible to understate how galvanizing Ukraine has been for the Taiwanese people. I mean, this kind of really, really pro-Taiwanese national movement, which is really kind of secured independence as the main de facto view on the island, really began with the Hong Kong protests and the crackdowns that followed there of a subsidiary of China, which, you know, was promised independence and promised democratic government, how that has been so effectively cracked down and kind of all those rights totally destroyed, really kind of discouraged Taiwan. And I think Ukraine has shown them how a people in a similar situation can find such courage and can find such resilience and fight back so effectively against seemingly overwhelming odds, that it really is kind of a similar situation on Taiwan. And I mean, Xi Jinping is desperate to get Taiwan back into kind of formally into the Chinese mainland. It's such an important strategic point, especially for their ambitions in the South China Sea and kind of counteracting Japan's influence. And, you know, the threat of invasion seems unlikely given America's kind of closest stance and far greater dependence on Taiwan than we had ties with Ukraine. Yeah. But, and Taiwan's kind of whole national defense has been really centered around repelling a Chinese invasion. Like, that is pretty much their sole focus. So it is inspiring to see how Ukraine, the people of Ukraine, have been able to defend themselves. But I think the Chinese military would also be far greater prepared and be far more efficient if they were to invade Taiwan.
Than Russia's would be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think, like, if anyone's going to come doing their homework, it's going to be, you know, more likely to be, you know, CCP than Vladimir Putin. But yeah, and it's a very, like, interesting strategic point for a lot of different reasons. Right now, you know, they kind of have this government that's very much caught in the middle in terms of economic control. Of course, you know, very much dependent on the West, or the West is very much dependent on them. But China would love to get more control on, you know, the Taiwan economy also, for a lot of reasons, because of, you know, those semiconductors that they're producing,
super
which
lucrative.
Are going to be a huge, huge deal. You know, that's having effects with the U.S. supply chains right now, from everything like computers to cars. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a very interesting situation there. They have diplomatic relations with just 14 countries. So it's going to be, you know, they're very much kind of in between, caught between the two, you know, big powers of the United States and the West here, but or in China. But, like, what could they do, if, you know, the worst were to happen? Would it be some sort of, you know, kind of supporting of the Taiwanese type situation, if like we're doing now with Ukraine?
At the very minimum, it would be, we would give far greater aid to Taiwan than we would to Ukraine, at the minimum. I mean, you can't really fully discount the possibility of U.S. troops helping solely to defend the island, given its total strategic importance to the United States, both economically. Like, it's really hard. It's the Taiwanese semiconductor industry is kind of one of the less seen lifebloods of the U.S. economy, especially in the digital age, and that is very, very crucial for aspects of commercial aspects and national defense, and that's not something our government would give up super easily, especially, and kind of ceding that territory to the Communist Party would further embolden action in the South China Sea and potentially other further ambitions, which is not something we would want to see. I mean, as I kind of said before, the Taiwanese people would be totally, it would be complete war. They would not cede an inch without, they wouldn't cede an inch. So that would be a really, really tragic situation if that were to come to pass.
Yeah, that would definitely be, you know, a very, you know, you just don't even want to think of it, especially with what is going on right now. By the numbers here, China's defense budget is about, you know, 20 times larger than Taiwan's, and you think they'd want to really kind of build it up. They may build it up by just like 0.2, I believe, from 2020 to 2022, but that is not to be decided quite yet. They actually have a bit of a, you know, troubled history with their military, because they had a military dictatorship that ended in 1987. Which has been, you know, the size of their army has been shrinking now just to, you know, what's regarded as 4 months of men. You know, the infantry's strongest skills are apparently painting walls, picking grass, and falsifying documents, according to an expert The Economist quoted here. For a time, Taiwanese thought that trade with China might stay its hand, but that didn't seem like she wanted to do that. So here's where the rethinking comes in. The stout resistance by Ukraine gives some Taiwanese hope that they too might be able to hold off a powerful foe, yet the war brings two sobering thoughts. One is that neither of the threat of sanctions nor the West's arming of Ukraine deterred Russia. The other is that Russia's nuclear threats have deterred America from intervening directly, and China too has nuclear weapons. So that is the thing, you know, with the nuclear question here, that has stopped America from doing probably so much more than what it wants to do, at least out in the open with Russia. How would that come to play when, of course, you're weighing the fact that so much of our, like, computer functionality depends on Taiwan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the U.S. was ever going to get put boots on the ground regardless of a nuclear option. And I don't think the nuclear option from Russia is deterring meaningful assistance to Ukraine in really any way. There was never really any situation where we were putting boots on the ground in order to help the government. That being said, I don't think... I think also the nuclear threat, what makes the Russian nuclear threat so scary, is how irrational of an actor Vladimir Putin is. He is proven himself to be kind of detached from reality and really have kind of his own secluded worldview surrounded by yes men who potentially could spiral into kind of a nuclear strike, which is so scary. I think the Chinese government would not use a nuclear weapon, especially against Taiwan, kind of the nation they've been proclaiming as brothers and saying as a rightful part of China for so many years. I don't believe a nuclear strike would kind of be in the cards, especially I would see them as far more rational actors than Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, I really feel like there's a lot less desperation there. Like, when you talk with, if you look at what some of the people in the Russian parliament or Russian TV and stuff were saying, they're like, you know, we're embarrassed as a nation post the Soviet Union. We're like, we don't feel like we have any kind of respect from the world. Like, this is our last-ditch effort to gain respect, where, you know, China, if you look what they've been doing, they've kind of been going the opposite direction. So
It's totally different scenarios. I mean, Russia wouldn't even be considered a world player if they didn't have gas or nukes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are really the two things that make it relevant and kind of earn their spot on the Security Council and whatnot. Without those, no one would really kind of give them the time of day. China, on the other hand, is obviously the world's second largest economy, huge consumer base, really fastly developing, though. don't know how long that will kind of continue in the future, given current party leadership. But they've proven time and time again that they are really contenders on the global stage and are kind of continuing to trailblaze in ways that people didn't think were possible.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. You know, if you look at what, you know, China is thinking about going into this, because that obviously is going to be the big question. You know, many in the West are obviously hoping that Putin's failures will give Xi pause, especially with, you know, as you talked about, they need to maintain more than really Putin, the mystique of the CCP and the People's Liberation Army, which has not fought a war since its border conflict with Vietnam in 1979. But China's generals will learn from Russia's mistakes with Ukraine, as they did from parallels to, you know, conflicts with Taiwan. From a technical point of view, the Ukraine issue can be indeed seen as a rehearsal for a Taiwan Strait crisis, said one analyst. So, yeah, you know, I think the thing, like, you know, tanks running out of gas like we saw in Russia, that most likely is not going to happen if, you know, something like this were to happen.
I mean, the Chinese war machine is pretty untested, and Taiwan has definitely been getting advice from the well-calibrated American generals and whatnot. So that's, I would say, far less likely that the Chinese army would encounter a lot of the logistical and kind of inner corruption struggles that Russia has been seeing. But at the end of the day, it's really, we won't know until if it happens.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting here, as Xi here seems to be getting older and seems to want to have it happen in his lifetime. So,
certainly.
You know, if he is that irrational, he's just like, no, I'm getting old, we got to do this thing. Like, that would be, you know, a whole nother thing as well. But in the end of the day, you know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Xi is such a fascinating figure, because he's really structuring himself to be kind of the next Mao Zedong. He is kind of simultaneously the party's greatest strength and weakness by tying himself solely to its core. There's no other figure that has anywhere close to, obviously, his power, and no one who can really dispute any action he takes. I mean, he's abolished term limits. He's setting himself up. I think in this coming year, he'll be reconfirmed for a third 5-year term, which is pretty unprecedented. But he's really kind of consolidating himself at the center of power, which is excellent for, I think, some of his past. Like, he executed the crackdown in Hong Kong especially well. He purged a lot of anti-corruption measures, were very successful within the party, and his economic measures as well have kind of defied expectations. But I think what we're seeing now, especially really tying it back to the beginning of the episode with zero COVID, when a policy of his isn't going right or isn't really following, meeting those same expectations, there's no real way to pivot or real kind of alternative method for something like that.
And so far, like, he hasn't really had to pivot in a really dramatic direction like this.
Well, I mean, it was, I think, the only potential pivot point, which was the Hong Kong riots. I mean, you had over a million people out on the streets, and things were starting to look a little dire, and then COVID happened. Boom, perfect excuse to execute all the authoritarian change that he was kind of hoping for. So he was...
And calls for national unity, all that stuff, you know.
I mean, when there's no protesters in the streets, because you can now kind of impose... You don't have to impose lockdowns based off of, like, martial law or really... You can impose lockdowns on public safety. He's able to shut those down pretty easily and then impose all the legislation, like the security bill, which we know now.
Yeah, that seems like a very scary roadmap for some bad things to happen. Let's hope that they stay relatively good, or at least not get any worse. Absolutely. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. That is all the time that
we have today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. We've got another great hour of WMFO coming your way.
Hi, I'm Charlize Theron with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Almost all the puppies for sale at your local mall were churned out by breeding facilities called puppy mills.
Constant confinement drives the dogs mad. They are impregnated continually until they can no longer produce a litter.
If you choose a dog from the mall, a dog you could have saved from the pound will die.
Contact PETA to learn how you can make a difference at 757-622-PETA or visit PETA.org.
It's cold here, I don't like it.